And last night someone mentioned about, it's an old debate, it should not be an old debate, it's very clear what the answer is. Satipatthana, Anapanasati, are they the same or are they different? And I did quote that sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, sutta number 118, where it says specifically that they are the same. And I thought that it might be useful at this particular point in our meditation retreat, when hopefully you've settled down, just to go over the Anapanasati Sutta and just to show how it's exactly the same as Satipatthana, and also how it does show you the stages of meditation which you can expect and how it all fits together. This is a big overview of the path of meditation. And sometimes one asks the question, why meditation on the breath? There are so many other different objects of meditation you can watch. You can do body awareness, you can do sweeping meditation, you can do awareness on loving kindness. There's many different types of meditation you can do. So why, first of all, the breath? And there's a few reasons for that. One is that the breath is a very comfortable object to watch once you settle into it. Sometimes it's hard to get into at the beginning, but once you have some awareness of the breath, it's very comforting and soothing. And now, because Buddhism and psychotherapy and psychology tend to feed off one another, they take most from the Buddhists, and we take a little bit every now and again from them. And from them I get the idea that the whole rhythm of your breathing is something which you can remember subconsciously from the earliest times of this life. When you were a fetus in your mother's womb, and many people can remember that time through past life memories or early life memories, and that is a very comforting rhythm. Remember where you're positioned in your mother's womb, and the rhythm which you know even more than her heartbeat is just the rise and fall of her tummy as she's breathing. And even in the first weeks of your life, whether it's breastfeeding or just being cuddled on your mother's tummy, that is a rhythm which you can remember as a sign of security, warmth, acceptance. It has some very powerful psychological connotations. It's one of the most comfortable rhythms, reassuring rhythms that you can know, mostly because of the early life memories. Once it becomes natural, obviously, when the breath is unnatural, you're forcing it, or you're excited or afraid, of course that breath is not reassuring at all, which is one of the reasons you can't maintain your awareness there for very long. But when you get into the rhythm of the breath, there's something about it, it's a slow, reassuring and very comforting type of rhythm. And I think that's one of the reasons, there's only one, why the breath meditation is a very good object to rest your attention on. And I say rest your attention rather than force your attention, because throughout this retreat you'll hear me say again and again, forcing, controlling, struggling goes against the very purposes of meditation and goes in the opposite way to the goal we're trying to be achieving: stillness, peace, comfort, joy. So it means that you can rest on something like the breath because it feels good. But even more than that, I also mentioned in passing yesterday, and some of these things which I mentioned in passing during the question time, I go into more detail in these morning talks. There is this idea that meditation is a way of letting go of the five senses so that you can become fully aware of the sixth sense when it is separated alone from all the other five senses. I gave the simile last night of the emperor covered in the five pieces of clothing. And the only real way you can know that emperor is to take off all the clothing so you can see the emperor in the raw. And that is based on a simile by the Buddha of the goldsmith. The only way a goldsmith can actually, number one, know the properties of true gold and then make it into ornaments or jewelry, they have to purify it first of all. You know, gold from the mine has got all sorts of other elements in it, which are impurities. So you smelt it, you do whatever you need to do to it to remove all the other trace elements until there's only gold, 100% pure, unadulterated gold, nothing else. And then, as a chemist, you can understand its properties. The same with the mind. If you want to understand what this mind is, as we asked last night, how do you know the mind? How can you reflect on the mind? How can you gain insight into the mind? You have to separate it out from all the other stuff, like all the other five senses. So you've just got mind, nothing but mind, 100% mind, nothing else. And then what you're watching, you can actually test out, understand, just like a chemist can understand the properties of an element once it's been purified. So a good way of understanding the process of meditation is finding a way to let go of these five senses so they stop, so they turn off. And so there's no seeing anymore, no hearing, no smell, no taste, not even awareness of the physical sensations of the body. They're all gone. And all you're left with then is the mind. Now during this retreat I'll be showing just the different ways of we can assist in letting go of these five senses to subdue them so they're not bothering us anymore, so they disappear. And the first thing I would say is that the way to let go of the senses is through stillness. When you are still, things disappear. I did also mention earlier that I did go once to a Zen retreat where they use this stick to whack you on the back if you were sleepy. You don't have to worry, we can't do that anymore. As I also mentioned, if any monk did that or any nun did that, you can ring up the police and they'll get arrested and they won't have a leg to stand on in court. Assault, you can't do that these days. However, all you can do is give people teddy bears. You don't get arrested for giving a teddy bear to somebody. So, in today's world. But one of the practices I did in that retreat, I've only done it once, never done it again, because it was strange, there's a much better way of doing it, was that in a Zen retreat, everyone was asked to face the wall. We were lined up in this corridor sort of hall, and everyone had to turn away from each other and just face the wall and look at the wall with your eyes open. Just stare at it. You weren't allowed to close your eyes. And you weren't given any much meditation instruction except be in the present moment. Try and be as silent and still as you possibly can. Don't think too much. And just look at the wall. And at that age, you're always willing to try anything once. You know, the age, I was about 22, 23, it's the age of adventure. You know, you want to give it a try, see what happens. So I was not stubborn. I wasn't trying to do it my way. I thought, this is interesting, never done this before, give it a go. So I was looking at that wall for about 15 minutes, and then it vanished. And that was weird. That was worth the whole retreat to experience that. And, you know, I thought, first of all, maybe they put some mushrooms in the breakfast or something weird. It was in the late 60s, early 70s. You know, who knows what was going on, but this was weird. You know, you were watching a wall, and then suddenly it wasn't there anymore. And that was strange. But at least I had a solid training in science. So when these things happen, you know, you find out why. You know, use the insight based on these experiences. And the insight came pretty quickly that this is not something magical, this is just the nature of the brain. It's only wired to notice things which change. Because I was reasonably quiet, I wasn't focusing on my thoughts, my memories or plans, I was in the moment, pretty still, just watching this black, white, washed wall, and it vanished. The reason was because nothing was happening. and the brain is highly efficient. If nothing's happening, that sense turns off. It's the same phenomena people know with the hearing. If there's a sound of a fan or a sound of the air con, if we put the air con on this afternoon, when it's first on, you can hear it. You can hear the buzz of the air con. But maybe it's 1 minute, 2 minutes, 10 minutes. After a while, you can't hear it anymore. Basically, the brain turns off from noticing it because it does not change. Even some people, there's one of our Thai ladies comes every week. She lives next to the airport. And when I was pointed out where her house was, it's right under the flight path. They said, you can't be able to sleep at night with all those planes taking off and landing, because they don't have, like in Sydney, they have a curfew where you can only take off and land at certain times, I think from 11 till 3 or whatever it is, or 4. You know, no planes allowed to come in or go out. But Perth Airport, they can come in whenever they want, midnight, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and she's right under the flight path. I said, can you go to sleep? And I said, yeah, of course, easy. I just lay down and go to sleep. She's so used to it that her brain doesn't notice it anymore. This is the nature of the mind. When something is always the same, even it could be loud sounds like aircraft taking off and landing, because the brain notices it's the sameness, the brain turns off, it doesn't notice it anymore. And that was the phenomenon of me watching that blank wall. Nothing was changing, so after a while, the sense of sight turned off. And the only weird thing was, it was with my eyes open. That had never happened to me before. But then I realized it happens to me all the time when I close my eyes. If you close your eyes right now, you can see the inside of your eyelids. But nothing changes, you're used to that. After a second, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, I don't know how long it takes you, the sense of sight turns off. It's not like you're seeing blankness anymore, you're not seeing anything. The sight turned off, just like you turn off an electric light. And this is the key to understanding why stillness is a way that you can expose the pure mind. Because you sit still, much of the feelings in the body vanish. You have to be kind, remember? Because if you're not kind, you've got an ache here and an ache there, a pain. I am just going to sit with this pain. I'm going to endure it. I'm not going to give in. Yeah, and you'll be watching pain for all of your meditation. There's the old joke, let's get these old jokes out of the way early so I can find some new ones later on. This is Anapanasati. Ana means along with, pana the breath, sati mindfulness. Anapanasati, mindfulness along with the breath, was taught by the Buddha. Anapanasati was not. Anapana means mindfulness along with pain. Please, anapana, yes. Anapana, no. So, if you're going to have your body, your sense of touch, vanish, it has to be soft. It has to be reasonably comfortable. So that's why aches and pains in the body are going to be a hindrance. Sit on a chair, sit on cushions, make it comfortable. Good chance the body will disappear. Quiet place, sound disappears. I'm asking you to be like burglars as you come in and go out so you don't make too much sound. Smells, tastes, it's very easy for them to disappear. Sight, closing your eyes is gone. The two hard things to shut down are sound and physical feelings. They're hard to shut down. But if you're sitting in a reasonably quiet place, and this is a quiet neighborhood, it's not that hard to shut down sound. Shutting down the body. Yes, you are sitting here, comfortable, nothing is moving, or is it? Because what happens naturally, whether you decide to do this or not, as things start to disappear, soon the only thing left moving is your breath is moving, your lungs are moving. And if you try and stop that, I've got to be still, okay, no breathing. You're going to die. Please don't do that. Otherwise we get in trouble. And it's very convenient, you know, somebody from Brazil or from Korea dies, you know, having to contact your embassies and consulates on a Sunday is a pain in the neck. So please, don't be selfish. Don't die because you want to. You know, please look after yourself. So, and you can't do that anyway. The breath will start again. So what happens when everything else disappears? The breath is the only thing left moving. And that's a very nice insight for me when I first understood this. But there you are meditating. You weren't trying to watch the breathing. You weren't trying to watch anything. You're just being still, relaxing, letting go. Not sort of disturbing anything. And then the sound vanished, the sight vanished, most of the feelings in the body vanished, but the thing which was left was the last thing moving, the breath. Which is why the breath will come up anyway, whether you go looking for it or not. So those are the two reasons I think the breath is the most popular, the type of meditation which most people use, the Buddha used, the Buddha recommended, because number one, sort of it's reassuring, and number two, it's a natural way of meditation. It's just what happens when you let go. But sometimes, even if you don't have the patience and the softness to allow it to come to you naturally, you can pick it up if you want to. And that is in the teachings of the Anapanasati Sutta, the 16 steps. And I better start, actually I'm not even going to start yet, you're going to do preliminaries first of all. And I love spending time on the preliminaries, because if you don't get the first steps perfect, the last steps will be in big trouble. In the same way you can make a big condominium, a 20, 30 story tower block, and if you don't do the foundations right, you know, yeah, first couple of stories, no problem. Six and seven stories, yeah, a bit wobbly, but that's okay. Nine and ten stories are beginning to sway. 15 stories, it falls over. You've got to spend time on the foundations. So the foundations of Anapanasati is you find a quiet spot, a secluded place. It's okay if you're an expert to go and meditate in the middle of the marketplace, but if you're beginning, that's the wrong place to start. You know, you start the easy places, the quiet places. So find a place of quiet and even solitude. You have a choice in this retreat. You can come in here and get the support of other meditators, and for some people that helps. You know, when other people are meditating with you, and you can see them and they can see you, there's a bit of like peer pressure. I better not fall asleep. You know, if I start snoring, other people are going to know about it. You know, if in your room you can do whatever you want. But you know, up here there's a bit of peer pressure. That sometimes can encourage you. But other times, no, you really need solitude. You know, you don't need the encouragement of fellow meditators. You just want a place where you can be by yourself, quiet, just arrange the environment and just go for it. So that's why we have your rooms there, which are really comfortable, I hope. So you can sit in either one, the quiet, secluded places. And then, so if you arouse mindfulness. Now for those of you who've studied that sutta, there is, again, some really dodgy translations. And you're not going to be critical of the people who made these translations, because they were translated into English about 150 years ago by people who were trying their very best. And they did a pretty good job. But, you know, we can improve upon that enormously these days. And somehow or other, just people refuse to improve and just they stick to the old translations, which are past their use-by date. The translation you will normally remember if you studied this sutta is you establish mindfulness in front of you. And that's confused a lot of people. What does it mean, mindfulness in front of you? So sometimes people think, where do I live? I live in my head. So mindfulness in front of me means here, on the tip of my nose. That is crazy stuff. Do not focus on the tip of your nose. This is breath meditation, not nose meditation. And if you focus on the tip of your nose, I'm not going to do this. I do this every retreat, if you focus on the tip of your nose, I usually demonstrate it. You've got your eyes closed, but your eyes will actually move to the tip of your nose. Now, if you were watching the tip of your nose during meditation, I peeled your eyelids up, you'd be cross-eyed. Because what you notice with your mind, you tend to look at with your eyes. It's just, you know, we're just so used to doing that, following, you know, our thoughts with our eyes. And we do that while we're meditating. And you can imagine being cross-eyed for half an hour. You get headache. And many people who watch the breath at the tip of the nose get a tension headache across here. Why? Just being cross-eyed, that's all. So don't watch the tip of the nose. You get headaches. You watch the breath. Okay. So what it means, it doesn't mean putting mindfulness in front of you. I learned this because, you know, going to Asia to become a monk 40 years ago, you know, if you know the old Asian culture, you ask a person where they lived, they were in here. They always thought they lived in their heart, not in their head. Now, Westerners, you know, we're up here. People say you've got a soul or a self. Where is it? They say here. No, Asians, down here somewhere. At least old Asians. These days, all Asians and Westerners are the same. You know, Caucasians, Asians, we've all got all mixed up. But that's why I remember just when the first heart transplant happened. People in Thailand, they just couldn't understand what was going on. Because, you know, it's like if you had a brain transplant today, if Sister go to me and my brain, we swapped. Okay. Now, would she be a monk and me a nun? Now, how would we wake up? Would she start telling silly jokes? What would happen if you had a brain transplant? Now, those sorts of questions were exactly the questions which Asians thought when you had a heart transplant. Who would you wake up as? Because the heart in Asia was the seat of the soul, the seat of who you were. So, mindfulness in front of you should have really been here somewhere, which doesn't make much sense. But that is not what the word means. It's purakata is the word in Pali. And it has an almost identical word in English, priority. Because priority means putting it first, putting it above, putting it in front, is what priority means. But it is a metaphorical in front, it's not a physical, you don't put it in front of something, it's in front in the list of things to do. You give it priority, it is the number one task to be done. And that is what that word meant in Pali. To give mindfulness priority to start off with. So before you even start watching the breath, establish some mindfulness. That's a priority. Put that in front of everything else. And once I explain it that way, it makes so much sense. If you're not mindful and you start trying to watch your breath, you can't do it. And today there is many people who come to me, they didn't learn from me, because I'm the perfect teacher. People, my students are always good. I'm also the most humble teacher, by the way. No, it's sometimes they come and say, oh, I tried the breath meditation, I can't do it. And well, how did you do it? Well, I sat down and watched my breath, and I can't do it. Of course you can't do it. You know, you've got to get your mindfulness strong enough, first of all, until you can see the breath and watch the breath. If your mindfulness isn't strong enough, you know, you just can't catch it. It just eludes you. You may lose some force, but after a while you just get frustrated. And it's such a shame. It's not just, you know, who's right and who's wrong. It's a disappointment for me that this great path of meditation, it was properly explained. Many people could do it and get enormous benefit. But when it's not properly explained, sometimes they try, they don't get anywhere, and they think that they can't do it. It's not they can't do it. It hasn't been done properly. So you establish mindfulness, first of all. You bring up mindfulness until it's strong enough that you can watch the breath without too much trouble. Now, what do I mean by establishing mindfulness, the priority, the first thing you do? Relax the body. Present moment awareness, kindness, that becomes mindfulness. In my first book, I wrote a very simple story. Some of those simple stories which you see in those books are far more profound than people give credit for. And one of those is perhaps the best story I can give you to explain what mindfulness is. It's the Emperor's Three Questions. When is the most important time? Now. Who is the most important person? I'm going to change it slightly. What is the most important thing? The thing right in front of you. Whatever that happens to be. In the story, the most important person, whoever is in front of you, whether that's a thief, a little kid, President Obama, doesn't matter who they are. If they're in front of you, they're the most important in the world. And the most important thing to do is to care. Kindness. Now that second one, the most important person was the person right in front of you. In meditation, the most important object to watch is whatever it is in front of you. Without choosing, I would just want to speak to important people. I'm not going to speak to little kids. I've got better things to do than to talk to bricklayers. No, if they're in front of you, they are important. Whatever experience is in front of you in the meditation, sloth and torpor, sexual fantasy, nimittas, what the highest and the lowest, please, they are important. Because if you don't give whatever's in front of you importance, you are not mindful. You're trying to get rid of something. You're trying to get somewhere else. You're not here. So that is mindfulness. Whatever you're experiencing right now, whatever it is, good, bad, ugly, whatever it is, that is the most important thing. Right now, be kind to it. That is mindfulness. So we're establishing that to begin with. We establish that first of all, and I use this as a dual objective to establish mindfulness and at the same time to relax your body. Be aware of your body feelings. Be kind to them. They are important. Forget about the breath. Your body is right in front of you. The ache, the pain, the heat, the cold. That is important. Be aware of it right now. Be kind to it. So that beginning part of meditation, which I taught about you yesterday, that is not just preparing the body so it can relax. It's also developing, starting up the engine of mindfulness, so that when your body is really relaxed, you have this whole attitude of being aware in this moment and being kind. You've established mindfulness. And you will know that you've established mindfulness to the right degree if, you know, you can let the body go and it's relaxed, it doesn't disturb you. And you can just ask the breath to come in. And sometimes you can wait for the breath to come in if you want. It comes in soon. Or you can just invite the breath in. And what do I mean by inviting the breath in? Again, the best way, the best method which I use and teach is to ask a simple question, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? How do I know? Very simple question. Everyone gets an answer. And you don't need it to explain it to me. You don't even need to explain it to yourself. How you know or where you know it. You just need to know the breath is going in or the breath is going out, that much. And that's all you need to know. Just the sensation. Whatever it is, wherever it is, that tells you the breath is going in, tells you the breath has stopped going in, tells you the breath has started going out, that sensation is all you need to focus on. Now, the first one, two stages of breath meditation, that sometimes you say breathing in and out with a long breath, breathing in and out with a short breath. Please, it could be the other way around, I don't remember, because it's not important. You don't have to do, I've got to do the long breath first. Once I finish the long breath, now I can go into stage two and do the short breath. And maybe I can do stage one and a half because my breath is not long. It's not short. It's in between. Ajahn Brahm, help. And it's, all this really is doing is giving you a little bit of extra stuff to watch until you can be mindful of the breath without worrying whether it's long or short. And because of that, we have developed all these different methods of doing stage one and two of breath meditation, just basically being aware of the breath. The one which I've been using a lot recently, and I'm sure it will change by this time next year, because, you know, you do have, you know, fads and fashions in meditation like anything else, is as you're breathing in, you recite a word to yourself, just to make the breath interesting, but also just to help with the path of relaxing. And I ask people, when you breathe in, to recite yourself the word, breathe in, peace. Breathe out, let go. So as you're breathing in, peace. Breathe out, let go. Because that's quite helpful for people. Because when they're focusing on the word peace as they breathe in, it makes the breath a little bit more interesting. And also, you know, by repeating to yourself, breathing in peace, breathing in peace, breathing in peace, with every breath consistently, you know, psychologically you do actually bring in peace into your mind. And breathe out, let go, this beautiful word, let go. All of the past, all of the future, all the pain, all the sickness, all the problems, all the aches. You can let go of everything when you keep telling yourself, let go, let go, let go, let go, with every breath. Imagine if you actually focused on that for, you know, 10 minutes or something, you would have to let go a lot. And you'd have to bring up a lot of peace into your mind. So that makes the breath interesting, and it gives it a bit of a boost of peace, a bit of boost of letting go. You don't have to do that. If you are Thai, you can do the old breathing in, breathing out, do, buddho, buddho, buddho. If you are Western or Australian, you can try that one which I taught years ago, because Westerners think so much. Breathing in, say to yourself, shut, breathing out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. And after a while, you know, people actually do shut up. Surprisingly, it works. You can make up your own if you want. It's really up to you. But what it is with the breath, you're giving it a little bit of interesting extra, makes it easier to focus. The other way is counting the breath. But I don't really want to teach that here, because there are too many accountants, too many people who just love numbers, and they love counting. They never get into meditation. They just have a nice time counting this and counting that. So just, no, let that go. But counting was the ancient way of doing these things. But it just means that you're watching an in-breath and an out-breath, giving it some interest. You only say that, say, long or short. Is this a long breath or is it a short breath? So it's not just watching your breath. It gives you something extra to focus on. If that doesn't work, another little exercise which does make it more interesting and gives you more attention on the breath, you can ask yourself to find the solution to this question. Which is the longer? The space between the in-breath and the out-breath, or the space between the out-breath and the in-breath? Which is longer? Now, it doesn't really matter which is longer, whether they're the same size or whatever. Just asking the question makes it more interesting. So you have to be more aware. Now, the breath has finished. That's an out-breath finish. Okay, in-breath has started. I've got to remember that. And then the in-breath finishes. Here we go. And the out-breath. It's just started. Was it longer or shorter? I better actually watch the next one as well. And the next one. It just makes you more mindful. It gives you an incentive. So it's just a little technique, a little trick, so you can become more aware of the breath. Now, all of those little tricks, whether it's counting, whether it's, you know, breathing in peace, breathing out, let go, shut up, or buddho, whatever, only do that at the beginning. Once, you know, you are settled down, once the breath is there and it's not going to go away, then forget about that. And just watch your breathing, the feeling, the sensation of the breath. Because what should happen next, once you're settled down, it's not just watching an in-breath or an out-breath anymore. You go to, you know, Anapanasati stage number 3. Already over halfway and I've only got to 3 stages. I've got another 13 to go. Doesn't matter, the other ones are quite fast. What happens then is you can start to see the whole of the breath. It's not just breathing in and breathing out. It's from the very beginning of an in-breath. You can see the time when it's just born. This breath starts to come into your body. You notice the sensation. And that sensation changes and it grows and evolves until it gets to the peak of an in-breath. And then it fades away as the in-breath cycle fades to nothing. And then you see this beautiful pause. You don't need to breathe out yet. The body is comfortable. It's just doing it by itself. And then the breath starts to exhale. First only a tiny bit of air going out and building up until it reaches its full volume of exhaust air. And then it fades away. It's just the last pieces of carbon dioxide came out from your body. The out-breath is finished. And there's another pause. You see so many different feelings and sensations of just one in-breath and one out-breath. What's happening there is your mindfulness is becoming stronger and more powerful, so you can see more. You're beginning to become focused and see the full breath. And the next stage is, these are things which you don't do. Please, this is not, yes, I've got stage 2, I will now move on to stage 3. Well, Ajahn Brahm, how do I know when to move from one stage to another? Wrong question. You don't move. The stages move. You just watch. You just like going in an aircraft, looking through the window. Going in a car, looking at the scenery. You are not driving, okay? These things happen naturally. And you can start to see more of the breath quite naturally. And the whole thing calms down. Why does it calm down? Because there's nothing to do. That is why. Why do you calm down at this retreat, whether you like it or not? It is because there's nothing much for you to do here. What can you do here? It's frustrating sometimes. Give me something to do. Sometimes, you know, all the chores, which, you know, you have to do some chores, chopping vegetables or whatever. You know, at first, oh, I don't want to do these chores. For some of you, please give me more chores. I want more things to do. Please, please give me something to do. Because we're all such neurotic doers. But here, you know, we've arranged it so you can't do very much. We do that on purpose. So you stop all this doing business. And because you don't do anything, there's hardly any work to be done here. Naturally, if you don't do anything else, you'll become calm. The activity of the body and the activity of the mind planning how to do it is basically reduced to a bare minimum. So you are going to calm down. It's natural with your life and nothing to do with you. Everything to do with the schedule and the way it's worked out here. You relax because there's nothing to do. That is what happens with the breath. Because there's nothing to do, breathing in, breathing out, the body does that and it does it very well. I've got nothing to do. The breath becomes very calm, very peaceful, all by itself. That's why when you start watching the breath, it may be a bit rough. The longer you watch it, the more peaceful, the more calm it becomes, naturally. And then the 5th and 6th stages, this is where the great part of meditation starts to happen. The pivot point. This is what I want everybody to achieve. And it's not that hard, because once you get here, then you are hooked. Then you are addicted. Then there's no way back. That's when you're breathing in and you start to bliss out. You start to experience what's called piti sukha, happiness. Breathing in with the breath, this is so nice. Breathing out, oh yeah, this is nice. The meditation starts to become enjoyable. Really enjoyable. The longer you sit, the more enjoyable it becomes. Sometimes people think meditation is this penance you have to do. You know, just like you have to go to church every Sunday even though you hate it because that's the only way you go to heaven. Okay, it's worth it if I'm going to go to eternity in heaven. But I hope there's no churches up in heaven. That's what I thought as a kid. And so many people think, oh yeah, you know, I've got to exercise, you know, to get fit and I just hate it. You'll give it up after a while. But if it's enjoyable, if you love doing it, of course you'll just keep on doing it. And that was one of the great things when I found about Buddhism and meditation. This was not a penance. This was a fun thing to do. When you get into it, it was the best thing you could possibly do. That's why I became an addicted meditator by becoming a monk. You know, like you've got Alcoholics Anonymous. No, the Sangha was like Bliss Anonymous. You know, just how we cope with the bliss. We get addicted to it, so we come here, we never lose it. But anyway, what happens is you start enjoying the meditation. You're breathing in and it's really enjoyable. You breathe out, oh, this is really nice. You're relaxing, you're at peace, and peace is one of the most wonderful, beautiful, delightful experiences. Now to show you how delightful that can be, I'm sure it will happen here on this retreat, because it usually happens on every retreat. Someone just gets into these fifth and sixth stages of meditation, just breathing in, breathing out, just so happy. And it's 11 o'clock. It's time for your lunch. And you're not going to have anything to eat until the following morning. Oh my goodness, what should I do? Carry on meditating or have lunch? No contest. You carry on meditating. And some of you will see that here on this retreat. I would expect that it comes to 11 o'clock and your friend is just sitting here with a silly smile on their face. They know it's lunchtime. But no, I'll do without lunch. It gives you an idea of just, you know, how happy the mind is. You don't want to come out. You're just having too much fun. I have lunch at a later time. And for many of you, I say this to the Asians because even more than Australians, Asians, they love their food. I mean, they really do. Every time I go to an Asian country, sometimes you arrive at the airport late and you get, you know, in a car, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning to go to the hotel or go to the monastery. And there are always people eating. 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, they're still eating. You never see that in Perth, you know, on the side of the road, you know, people eating at all hours. But yeah, in Asia, I understand, you know, that you guys, you know, you're really into your food. But even you, when it gets to beautiful meditation, no, you don't want food anymore. Now that gives you an idea of what the happiness is. And so you get to that space, it's not that hard, and then you really enjoy, wow, this is what meditation is, it's actually fun. And that's only the beginning, baby. It's just starting, wow, you ain't seen nothing yet. So what happens, that's the fifth and sixth stage of the meditation. The Buddha said those first four stages when you're watching the breath, that's just like watching the body. That's the first satipatthana. That fulfills the first satipatthana, just seeing that much. And now, it's important to know this, because now the object of your meditation is not the breath anymore. It's the joy. You're watching vedana, feelings, the second satipatthana. The joy. Yeah, you can feel the breath there, but that's not the main thing you're watching. The main thing which is keeping your attention is just how delightful this is. And it gets very delightful. The delight gets smoother and smoother. You feel that the whole delight, that's the seventh. And the eighth stage, the delight gets incredibly profound. As the breath becomes so smooth, so incredibly smooth, just like everything else, when it gets smooth, it vanishes. So from the eighth stage of the breath or the bliss becoming really smooth, then you get to the ninth stage of Anapanasati. And that's when you see the nimitta, this beautiful light comes into your mind. So you're watching the breath, it's so beautiful, so nice, a very smooth breath. The breath vanishes, you can't see it anymore, it's gone. Because what you're left with now is incredible, beautiful light which pops up into the mind. Now I can give a whole talk about the nimittas. There's all types of nimittas. Sometimes they come early, sometimes they come late, sometimes they're like fireworks, sometimes like they're a point. There can be all sorts of different colors. They can be complicated nimittas where you see lots of scenery. They can be up here in the corner. There's so much to say about nimittas, but the general principle, the really good ones, I can tell you how to develop these afterwards. Just beautiful light, like a moon, or like a flashlight, like a sun, comes right in front of you. And that is the ninth stage of the Anapanasati. Chittam Pati Samvedi. You are experiencing the mind. Because the breath has been this stepping stone, the last piece of body awareness now is vanished. And with it all the five senses are either all gone or mostly gone. Yes, in nimittas you can still hear sounds sometimes, but a long way away they don't disturb you. Yeah, you can have a thought every now and again, but not that great. But when the nimitta really establishes itself and gets strong, the sounds get much weaker, the thoughts hardly anything left at all, as the nimitta grows. And here, what you're seeing is a reflection of your citta. So for those of you, the one who asks, how do I experience this mind? This is the first place you can experience the mind. And I'll tell you how you know you're experiencing the mind is because sometimes you will see a nimitta, and it's a beautiful nimitta. Sometimes you'll see a nimitta and it's dirty. It's got like a smear, like a stain, like you spilled some coffee on a shirt or something. And you know why it feels a little bit dirty? Because you have broken some precept. You have been naughty. You have, you know, not been such a good person, you know, maybe lied or cheated or something. And you can actually dismiss that for yourself. Oh, it just needs to be done. Everybody does it. Rah, 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 rah. But my goodness, when you get this nimitta coming up, it's a reflection of your citta. And you know, it doesn't look so pure. You know why? And as soon as you see that, oh God, I know why. You know, then you remember what you did. Now don't get guilty about yourself, because you know, everybody makes mistakes and does stupid, selfish things from time to time. But be honest about it. And here, you have to be honest. It's right in front of you. And there's a way out of that, and I'll tell you later on when. But I won't tell you now, because I want you to be good, not break your precept. But I know all the loopholes. Getting around this. So I've been doing this a long time. I'll teach you those later on. But for now, actually, you're seeing your mind. And if there's any imperfections of virtue, you see it. You know, it's totally honest. You can't sort of deceive yourself anymore. It's amazing how we can deceive ourselves. Oh, it just does. Oh, everyone else does it. Oh, it's only a small bit. No, it doesn't really matter. You know, you can convince yourself, but when these things come up, it's, you know, you're just basically looking at yourself in the mirror. You know, you can't deny what's happening. So here, actually, you're finding out the importance of virtue. You know, it's not virtue. Sometimes people say, why be good? You know, some people even think, we only live one life. Why be good? You know, if you can get away with it, great. You know, have mistresses, you know, cheat, steal or whatever. You can get away with it. You know, good on you. You only live once. But that is not sort of how it actually works. The virtue does affect your mind. Good people have pure minds. You know, we even say that in the English language. You're such a pure-minded person. And you don't realize how true that is until you see this nimitta. You see just how the purity of your livelihood, you know, depends. It will show up on the power of your nimitta. And I've been doing this for such a long time, especially teaching. You know, you can tell. You know, for those people I know really well, You know, people who live in Perth, they come to our Buddhist society, they offer food and give donations, they serve on committees and stuff. You know, because you get to know them, you know, you get to know who the pure-hearted people are. You know, that. There's some people who are just such good people. You can trust them with anything. And they will always drop whatever they're doing to come and help, even if they're busy, you know, to help you. You know these really pure, good-hearted people? There's a benefit to that. When they get to the nimitta stage, their nimitta is gorgeous. They deserve it. You know, they've earned it. They're gorgeous nimittas, and they have an easy job for the next, you know, two or three stages. But don't be disappointed. Again, I'll tell you the loopholes later on. If you haven't been so good, you've been a bit stingy, you know, life has been a bit hard, don't worry, I can get you out of the problem. I'm a great lawyer. But in the meantime, this is what happens. You see this nimitta coming up. That's, you're seeing your jitta, your mind. And that is also why, for those people who've read this quote, is such an oft-quote passage, I'll include it now. This mind is pabhasvara. It's radiant when there aren't any defilements around. And this is, you're experiencing that saying of the Buddha. You've got this mind here that's brilliant, it's radiant. That's what the Buddha was talking about, stage 9 of Anapanasati. But then for most people, you know, when you sort of have a nimitta, it's not bright enough yet. It's a bit dirty. So stage 10 is actually how you can learn to brighten up this nimitta. You know, just make all these little defects sort of vanish and make it bright and brilliant. It literally is actually what I call shining up your nimitta, making it more and more brilliant. I'm not going to go into it now because it's a detailed description of how you do this. But then afterwards, sometimes the nimitta is a bit unstable and moves all over the place. Now you've got to still the nimitta, samadhan, which is the 11th stage, to keep this light so it's totally still. It doesn't move, it doesn't throb, it doesn't disappear, but it stays right in front of you, brighter and brighter and brighter. That's the 11th stage. And the 12th stage. Warm. Thereby you enter the jhanas. The mind is now freed. It's called freedom. Freedom from what does it mean here? This is the time the mind is freed from the five senses. Yes, you know, you see the nimitta, it's really bright. You know, you can see sort of the emperor, most of his clothes or her clothes or its clothes are taken off, but he's still got a few of the remnants of the five senses. But when you enter the jhana, the 12th stage of Anapanasati, that's when the mind is freed from the five senses. No more hearing, no more seeing, no more smelling, no more tasting, no more touching. Someone can knock you on the shoulder and you don't know that you'll be knocked. It's turned off. Those are the jhanas. Now, that is the Anapanasati Sutta up to stage 12. Entering the jhanas. This is where you understand what the mind is. That is the third Satipatthana, Cittanasati. And, of course, you don't stay forever in the jhanas. You come out afterwards. And when you come out of these jhanas, wow! That was awesome. That was huge. That was amazing. I often say that, you know, quite a lot of people get these jhanas. And I often say, this is a bit of a joke, it's such a shame that we are Buddhists and not Christians. Because if you were a Christian and you got first jhana and you went to go and see the bishop or the pope or somebody, they will say, and you will describe it as union with God. I merged with the ultimate. Total bliss, and just like I wasn't there. And they would make you a saint. You would be called Saint Gotami. Saint Leo. You would have a school named over after you, Leo. Saint Leo's. A And all it is a jhana, that's all. So, you know, you really don't get the reward you deserve in this religion. It's really unfair. But, you know, those people who became saints in the Middle Ages, some of those, you know, I look at them and, yeah, it was a jhana. Because they surrendered. They surrendered to God or surrendered to something. They let go. And they got into these bliss states. And they named a hospital after them. We don't get anything named after us. Anyway, never mind. That's not what we're there for. So, and this is, when it disappears, the jhana vanishes, then you start wondering what the heck's gone on. These are huge experiences. Whether you like it or not, whether you want to or not, you will look back and say, what the hell was that? That was immense. What's going on? That is where you reflect on incredible experiences. And this is where you do the insights. The insights which come after jhana. Understanding, they say, the four things of the Satipatthana, Patinisaga, renunciation. You gave up something, you let go of something. Huge things. Viraga. Viraga is things faded away. The senses faded away and they disappeared. They ceased. That's the Nirodha. Anicca also. I've missed out the Anicca. People think Anicca means rise and fall, seeing things come and go. You can go down to the lake down below and see the waves. That's not rise and fall. Rise and fall when you go down the lake down there and you watch it very still. Nothing moves. And then the lake vanishes. That's Anicca. My first experience of Anicca was seeing the wall vanish. That's Anicca. Something which was there has vanished. It's gone, disappeared. And it's not supposed to vanish. Things which you relied upon. Things which you thought were so stable. Things which were just essential. Disappear. That is Anicca. So that's actually how one happens for the last four Satipatthanas, the insight practices. So I started on this little talk, 16 stages of Anapanasati, linked them with the Satipatthana. But hopefully I've taken you from just the one in front of you is the most important person. Simple stuff which you read maybe in opening the door of your heart. Oh, this is just ordinary stuff, ordinary Buddhists, even for non-Buddhists. I'm taking you from there into seeing things disappear which you never expected would disappear. The great insights which make you enlightened. Taking you through the jhanas. Stage by stage, and every stage is possible for you. You understand how it works. You don't do it, it just happens. Little by little, starting off with just sitting quietly, arousing mindfulness as a priority. This experience in front of me is the most important, and I'm going to be kind with it. Little by little, you can experience the breath. Breathing in peace, breathing out, let go. Until you don't need those words anymore, you have the breath. The breath becomes full awareness of the breath, beginning to end. And it gets delightful. That's why I said the delight is the key. Once you get to that stage, everything else will just snowball. Delightful breath, breathing in, oh, it's so nice, breathing out, so nice. Just let go, don't interfere with the process. All problems from that stage on is you interfering. Just let go, don't do anything. Go there for the ride. See where you end up, and then you have some great fun. And all these things happen. The breath vanishes, beautiful nimittas appear. I become stable. Bliss, literally greater than you'd ever expect. And then the jhanas. Wow. And then enlightenment. So easy. And all for just $25 a day. Oh. And with meals included. Okay, so there's Anapanasati Sutta for you. Okay, I've given you a lot of oomph there, so now just go and do it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu.
Very good.